As we bring our palms together in veneration, let us remind of the great teacher as well as all of the disciples who have since his time walked the surface of this earth and spread the truth of life, of our purpose of existence, and of everything else, so that you, I, and everyone could benefit and enjoy the eternal bliss of Nibbana. Let us also take this moment to renew our pledge of allegiance to the Noble Triple Gem, that is nothing other than the ultimate truth, as I'm sure you will have begun to realize by now, and those who have only just begun will soon do. Let us also take a moment to observe the five precepts and continue with today's proceedings.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
As always, we have some new faces in the audience. A warm welcome to all of you. Welcome home. I know that sounds like the thing to say, but after a while you realize that was the invitation you were waiting to hear. Why do we call this home? Actually, as a matter of fact, you know, when I say welcome home, is it the school I refer to? What is home? Home is? Yes. Home is where the heart is, of course. You have come here, I believe, to discover something about yourself. All of you, whenever we started this journey, whenever you arrived here, take yourselves back to the first day you walked in through these doors. To put it quite simply, we were all lost. Don't you think so? We always go somewhere to find answers. Why do you go to the barbers? To find the Dhamma. No, you go there to find answers. Answers to what? Answers to a problem. A solution to a problem. And what sort of problem do you go to the barbers for? Well, I think it's obvious. Why do you go to the doctors? To find answers to a problem. A solution to a problem. Why do you go to the grocers? Yet again. See, we human beings, we have this innate ability to go seeking answers, don't we? That's what makes us special. We can pick and choose. We can be inspired. I think that sets us apart from other beasts, four-legged creatures, other beasts. You can't inspire a monkey. Have you ever seen an inspired monkey? You can train a monkey, but you can't inspire a monkey. You can't motivate a monkey, but you can inspire a human being. Do you understand the difference between an inspiration and a motivation? I've been thinking about this lately. See, it's a bit like this. Here's a mountain. And it has a pinnacle. Up here is a tree. Can you see this from the back? is the projector up? It's not switched on? Ah. Here is the mountain. Up here is a tree. Now can you see it in the back? Okay. On this tree bears fruit. It bears delicious fruit. Let's say it's an apple tree.
There's a man.
I mean, that's quite a steep mountain, but that's besides the point. There's a man who's hungry. Okay? We tell the man that there are those who climb this mountain. There are those who climb this mountain up to the tree, this tree which bears fruit. They pluck the apples and they eat it. And these apples are delicious, they're so filling, and those who have made up this track, this journey, they enjoy the fruits of their labor. So they enjoy the fruits of the tree. You tell that story to this man who is at the foot of the mountain. You know what this man starts thinking? He thinks, wow, isn't that such a wonderful thing to do? That's good. There are people, they're hungry, they climb up mountains, they go up to the tree, this tree which bears fruit, and there's an abundance of fruit there. There's enough for everyone and more. So there's plenty of it. Is it not so good that all these people climbing up the mountain, they can pluck these fruits and they can eat it and then they can sate their hunger? This man is inspired. This man's inspired because now he knows that there's a problem out there in the world to which people seek answers, and the answer is on the top of a mountain. He's inspired, but he's not motivated. So you see, to be inspired, you just need to know that there's a problem to which there's a solution. These two things exist somewhere out there. Someone has a problem, and to that, someone has found a solution. You know when he becomes motivated? He becomes motivated when he sees the problem within him. Right now he knows that when you're hungry, you can go up a mountain, you can pluck the fruit and you can eat it, and that will sate your hunger. He's inspired. In fact, he's a philosopher. He can now preach. But does he practice? Not quite. He preaches. He can now go from door to door, from town to town, village to village, house to house, and he can share with people what he has learned. He can go up to the next person he meets on the street and go, hey, you know what? There's a mountain up there. And on there, there's a tree. On that tree, there's plenty of fruit. And if you're hungry, you can go up there, pluck the fruit and eat it. So he's a good philosopher. But he doesn't quite yet practice what he preaches, because here's what he hasn't done yet. He's not seen the problem within him. That's the difference between inspiration and motivation. Once he begins to see the problem within himself, if we can get him to see the problem within himself, if he, by sheer luck, good fortune, whatever you want to dress it up as, finds a teacher, comes across someone who can show that there's a problem that lies within himself, now he wants to take action. Someone who's motivated takes action. Someone who's inspired shares with others a nice story. I like to think I practice what I preach. I like to think that you're all here because you also like to practice what I preach. I like to think that. Can I continue to think that? Thank you. Are you inspired to aspire Nibbana, or are you motivated to aspire Nibbana, to achieve Nibbana? Which one? Put Nibbana to a side, because not everyone might be familiar with what Nibbana is. It's a word we've heard. There's a band called Nirvana. Right? So Nirvana comes in all shapes and sizes. It's different things for different people. I'm talking about what we talked about a couple of weeks ago. A happiness that cannot be shaken. Regardless and despite whatever happens around you. Take just a brief moment to ask yourself this question. To this day, ladies and gentlemen, aren't there things in the world out there that can topple you over? You wake up one morning and think, oh, today's a lovely day. You stretch your arms and your legs. You take in a breath of fresh air and you think, today's going to be a fantastic day. And you walk into the kitchen. Or you walk into the living room. Or you pick up your phone. Or you walk into the courtyard. Or you look around and see you see your husband. So many things can still go wrong in your life that can shake your happiness. The day you are inspired is the day you know that something can be done about this. The day you're motivated is the day that you begin to do something about it. Are you inspired or are you motivated? Don't answer to me. Answer to yourselves. It's good to be inspired. A name comes to my mind. A monk who was very, very, very inspired in the Buddha's time. His name was Potila. Have you heard of him? Give me a show of hands if you've heard of this name, Potila. A few of you. All right, okay. So he was a monk. His name was Venerable Potila. And he was a very good philosopher. He was one of the best. You know, he had many students. Many, many students. He would go from town to town, carrying his alms bowl in his robes, sharing the Buddha's message. He would go walk up to people and say, hey, you know what? My teacher, the Buddha, he says you must aspire to Nibbana. You must practice the Noble Eightfold Path. What the heck are you doing? Go practice the Noble Eightfold Path. Attain to Nibbana. He would go from place to place, town to town. He would be a wanderer and he would spread the Buddha's message. So he did this for a few years of his good life. And then one fine day he thought, I must now go back to the Buddha and share with him what I have been doing as a monk. I'm sure he will be very impressed. Or so he thought. So he walked up to the Buddha. The Buddha was sat in meditation. So he waited for his turn, as all good monks do, as all good students do. And then when the Buddha woke up from his meditation, he walked up to him, worshipped, circumambulated, and then said, Venerable Sir, I have something to share with you. The Buddha asked, yes, what is it, Potila? Venerable Sir, from the day I ordained in this asana, I have been sharing your message far and wide. There are many of my students who have gone on to achieve great fruits. By this point, you know, I don't mean about the apple fruits. I mean the noble fruits. They have gone on to become Sakrudagamis, Anagamis, and even Arahants. Not Sotapannas though. You note, I never said that. Because it is only a Sotapanna who can help another become a Sotapanna. This monk was not one. Why? Well, you'll figure out soon enough. But he went around preaching the Buddha's teaching. He heard from the Buddha, he heard from other disciples like the great elders Sariputta, Mahamoggallana, Mahakashyapa and so on. He was a messenger. He carried the message. So he was sharing this news with the Buddha. Sir, I've been doing this for the good part of the last few years. And the Buddha remained silent. He couldn't get the response that he wanted from the Buddha. Of course, you know, what would any student want from their teacher? After having shared with them their adventures and all the good stuff that they've been doing, what would they want? Some praise, some acknowledgement. But the Buddha remained perfectly still, perfectly silent. So he tries it again. He says, Sir, I have been a very good student of yours. I have lots of students in the several hundreds. I've been sharing this message with so many people and many have gone on to achieve great fruits. So he adjusts himself and again waits for a response from the Buddha. Does one come? No. So he tries another time. He says, Venerable Sir, I'm sure you know that this is not the only sasana in which I have done this. In the ministry of previous Buddhas as well, I have been a fabulous disciple of theirs and I have carried their message. Every time I came across a Buddha, I've carried their message from person to person, town to town, village to village, spreading the Buddha's teachings. And many have gone on to attain the ultimate fruit of Nibbana. So once again, he waits for a response. Only this time round he gets one. Normally, when you provoke the Buddha, provoke in a good way, you can't anger him. On three occasions, on the third one, he normally responds. So he says, well, actually, what happens is he doesn't get a response even on the third occasion, but so therefore, you know, lacking a response, he gets up and is now about to leave. That's what he does. He adjusts himself, no response coming from the Buddha, so he gets up to leave. And on this occasion, the Buddha says, Tuccha, Tuccha Potila. Are you taking your leave? Do you understand the meaning of the word Tuccha? No, not all of you do. Let's put it in a polite sense. It is actually very polite. The Buddha was never rude to anybody. This word is a word that is used to insult people. It's like useless fellow. But there's a much more profound meaning to it. Back then, he probably would have used that word in that sense, but today it means something that is useless, something that is essenceless, something that is meaningless. But back then it had a much more profound meaning. What it meant was someone who had gone beyond the purpose of what something was intended for. In other words, Potila, this monk, had gone around preaching the Buddha's Dhamma, inspiring others, even maybe motivating others, but he was not motivated himself. Therefore, he had never gone on to practice the Buddha's teaching. Otherwise, would he have been around in this Buddha's ministry if he had done so in the previous Buddha's ministry? Certainly not. He would have gone on to become an Arahant. See, this man, he was inspired, but he was not motivated. So what I'm saying is there have been monks in the Buddha's sasana, even in the presence of a Buddha, who were not motivated. But upon hearing these words from the Buddha, he was shocked. He was shocked to the core, you can imagine, because he'd come to the Buddha for praise, for acknowledgement. And did he get that? Far from that. So on this occasion, he was quite shocked to hear all this. And then he broke down. He got on his knees. And he said, Venerable Sir, why do you speak to me like this? I have been one of your perfect disciples. Why do you speak to me like this? I was hoping you would acknowledge my contribution to the sasana. I was hoping you would praise me and honor me. But no, you call me as a tuccha. Why is it so? He says, Potila, the purpose I preach the Dhamma to you is not so that you can go taking this message from house to house and do that as your primary purpose. That has to be a secondary purpose. Your primary purpose has to be your own salvation, because no one else can do it for you. You're doing what others can do to others, but you're not doing what only you can do for yourself. And this was the point where Potila, the monk, realized that he had failed the Buddha Sasana. You know what he did from there on? He went looking for a teacher. This is the Buddha's instruction. He said, now go find a teacher. Now you might have wondered, well, why couldn't the Buddha be a teacher to him? You know, of all teachers, why couldn't the Buddha be a teacher? Because he had a few lessons to learn that he would not learn from the Buddha. One lesson he had to learn was the lesson of humility. To be humble. You can imagine, Potila, this monk, he had many followers. Hundreds, if not thousands of followers. Can you imagine the kind of teacher he might have been, having understood no Dhamma at all? He had not become a Sotapanna. He had not comprehended the Dhamma. So therefore, the Dhamma had not made a change within him. So what do you think that would have done to his ego? A very egotistical person. So had the Buddha been his teacher, he would never have gone on to become an arahant. Because then he would have gone around telling others what? You know who my teacher is? So that would not have worked. Therefore, the Buddha, in all his wisdom, said, go find a teacher. That made things even worse for him. Because here's a man who was a teacher to many thousands of students. Now try going and finding a teacher amongst them. So he would go from village to village to his very students who he had taught. And he went and asked them, please, would you be my teacher? What would all of the monks say? Venerable Potila, sir, how can I be your teacher? You have been our teacher for all these years. Good gosh, just the thought of it. I could never do something like that. Please, sir. I could never do something like that. So they rejected him. They refused to be his teacher. See, this is what happens when you get onto the top branch of a tree. It's very difficult to get back down. You've got to be careful. When you get up on that tree, it's difficult to get back down if you're not prepared to come back down. If you forget your roots. This is good advice to monks particularly. And also you people, because you will find yourselves have become, I think quite a few of you, if not many of you, have now become figures in and amongst your family and your associations. Maybe, you know, you have started sharing bits of the Dhamma that you have learned. People begin to respect you, don't they? When you're among a group of friends, right, and they know that you are one of the people who come to the Sunday sermons, or you have become so religious and so, you know, devoted to the Buddha Sasana, you are now practicing the Dhamma, people who have problems in their lives, your friends, your family, they will now begin to regard you with respect and reverence. You don't have to be a monk for that. And if you're not careful, you can become another Potila. If you forget your roots. See, with the Dhamma, once you start preaching, you become an icon. Because this is the best thing that anyone could share with anybody else, because there is nothing wrong with it, that it is flawless. I would have a tough time selling a car to you because a car has flaws. I would have a tough time selling a washing machine to you because it has flaws. I would have a tough time selling a house or a mansion to you because it has flaws. It has its weakness and it has its strengths. What are the weaknesses of the Dhamma? What are the weaknesses of the Dhamma? There are no weaknesses. Therefore, what I have to sell to you is the best product that any salesman would want to sell. This is perfect in every single way. Therefore, when you become the salesman, selling the product of the Dhamma, you're selling something that is perfect in every single way. You don't have to convince too much. Those with intelligence, those with wisdom, they begin to understand, they begin to realize. And soon enough, the respect, the reverence, the veneration, the praise and the honor, they all start getting directed towards you. It will come. It will happen if it hasn't happened already. This is something to watch out for. And then what happens is, if you are not someone who has been motivated, but only inspired, whereas you have become the carrier of the message, but you have not become the message, then what's going to happen is, because you have not applied the Dhamma to yourself, it has done note for your ego. And we all thrive, don't we? When we get praise and honor and people regard us highly, we all thrive in that environment. I know what I was like, you know what you were like. It happened to Potila. It has happened to some of the best people in the sasana. It can happen to others as well. The difference there is, to avoid this peril, what I'm asking you to do is not to share the Dhamma with others. You must. A lot of you bring along your friends, families, distant relations, and some have benefited immensely from that. I shared with you the other day, the gentleman who had come from Bulgaria, he wrote a book about his experience of having visited us. He sent me a copy. I'm just reading it these days, and I'll bring it along with me either next week or one of these weeks and share with you a few snippets of his experience of having walked in through these doors. And his first experience was not seeing the Swaminuhanse. His first experience was being greeted by you. And what a profound impact that had on him. As well as the people who had spoken to him about this program and had encouraged him to come here. He's ever so grateful to them. In his book, he shares his gratitude. I'll share some of that with you next week. So what I left him with when he, on his last visit to the monastery was, I want you now to take the Dhamma to Bulgaria. And he promised he would. So now he has been coming back to us over the phone, online, and asking us for help to help him take the Dhamma to his fellow countrymen and women. See, you're doing the same. Perhaps the reason he is here is because one of you invited him to come along. Perhaps every one of you are here or is here is because someone else invited you, encouraged you to come along. And that's wonderful, that's great. But in my life, ladies and gentlemen, I have seen my fair share of individuals who have encouraged, invited others to come along, and that seemed to be the end of the track for them. That has happened many times. In fact, if I had a dollar for every time that happened, I'd be a very rich man today. It tends to happen. Sometimes their role is to hold someone's hand, bring them along, get them sat down, and then they leave. That happens because they're inspired, just not motivated. I want you to be motivated. Your motivation does not come from my motivational speech. That's not how it happens. For that, Shraddha needs to happen within you. Shraddha is not just blind faith. Shraddha is your conviction. How can you be convicted of something? Not as in convicted criminal. How can you have conviction of something? How do you know that water quenches thirst? Did you read it in a book? You see someone drinking water and you think, oh, it must, apparently it does. Is that how you know that water quenches thirst? How do you know water quenches thirst? You've tried it, you've done it. Initially you were inspired, you saw someone drinking water when they were thirsty, but then you were motivated because you were thirsty, you got a bottle of water, you drank it, and your thirst was quenched, and now you're motivated. Does anyone need to remind you, advise you, instruct you now to do what you need to do when you're thirsty? It's no longer necessary. Because now you are motivated. Whenever you are thirsty, whenever you experience thirst, you know exactly what to do. I'm asking you this question, folks. Are you here because you're motivated? Or are you here because you're inspired? If you're here because you're inspired, there's still a little bit more work for me to do. If you're here because you're motivated, there is nothing really left for me to do. The Dhamma will do all that. I want a room full of people who are motivated. Meaning, they realize that they are hungry. They realize that they are hungry. They have seen that there's a tree up the mountain which bears fruit, and that fruit can sate their hunger. At that point, I don't need to shimmy them along. I don't need to push them along. They will do so on their own account. What better gift can you give a teacher than relieve them of the burden of having to push you along on the journey to Nibbana or any destination for that matter? See, when most of you come up to me at the end of a sermon and you say, Swami Nuhansa, so impressed by that sermon. Swami Nuhansa, wonderful sermon. Swami Nuhansa, thank you so much for that sermon. You know, the best gift you can give me, you don't need to let me know, I just need this to happen within you, is for you to become motivated for the purpose of Nibbana. By which I mean, with or without my presence, you will work towards that. Because I can't guarantee that we will meet next week. This might be your last day, it might be mine. But if you are motivated to Nibbana, then you will continue on this journey until you have attained the ultimate fruit. For that to happen, you need to realize the problem where? Where? Where must you see the problem? Within you. Have you? What is the first noble truth? The first noble truth of suffering in someone else. Yes? Yes? The first noble truth of suffering in someone else. Is that so? No. This is why it is so crucial, so critically important, that when we talk about the Dhamma, take last week or the week before last for that matter, I took a number of examples from your own life. I talked about your car, I talked about your children, I talked about your home, I talked about your most prized possessions, and I asked you this question. When did you ever get to enjoy the things that you possessed? Remember? And then I asked you to do some homework. Uh-oh. Do you remember? I asked you to do some homework. I remember. I always remember. What was the homework? Exactly. I asked you, on your way back, you're going to stop by your car, yes? Open the door, get into your car, and then, on the way home, I asked you to do something. Do you remember what that was? I asked you to contemplate the moments where you actually get to enjoy the fact that you are a proud car owner. How many moments did you actually enjoy that experience versus the number of moments where you dreaded? Dreaded what? Getting in an accident. Running your car into something. Losing control. Someone running into you. Someone jumping across the road without warning. Remember? And then when you get back home, take account. of the number of moments where you actually got to enjoy the fact that you are a proud car owner versus the moments where you were left in fear and what? And grief. Have you done your homework? Well, for those of you who have, what are the results? How many moments of that experience on the way back home did you actually enjoy? That's all you thought about. Wow, I'm a proud car owner. See, I'm rocking my ride. Was that all you got to think about? All you thought about? Or was it for a mere split second you started the car and the moment you put your foot on the pedal, from that point forward, you just had to forget all that? Why so? Because you have to keep your eyes on the road. Look for oncoming traffic. Look to see if there's people jumping across the road. And you have to keep your property safe. Safe from oncoming threats. So did you really enjoy the ride back home? No, I spoiled it for you, didn't I? Yeah, keep coming to these sermons, I'll spoil everything for you. So that's your car. What about your girlfriend? Now. Come on, look at me right in my eyes. What about your girlfriend? If you made a list of the moments in a 24-hour day, the number of, well, you can't count them in hours, right? Because things change so rapidly. If you were, I know this is impossible to do this almost, but you can do it this way. If you could take maybe half a day, here's what you can do. But you must remember and do these things, right? That's when you become motivated. Otherwise, you're just inspired. I need you to shift from motivated, shift up a gear to from inspired to motivated, because I need to create within you the energy to drive yourself. That is my task. It is my purpose of coming along here every week. Because I know there's going to be a day where you and I are not going to meet, ladies and gentlemen. We're not just here for the ride. I'm not just here to come and give you a few talks and, you know, get to be known as the monk who gives talks. What's that for? I've done that plenty of times in previous lives and I've been a portillo myself. I don't want to be another one. In one buddhasasana, one portillo is enough. We don't need two of them. So that is not what I'm here for. I need you to be motivated so that you can self-drive. I want you to become a Tesla. I want you to go on autopilot. So you don't need the driver. You can drive yourself. You can drive yourself to Nibbana. What is a Sotapanna after all? Who is a Sotapanna after all? One who is a stream enterer. Why do they call them a stream enterer? Because once you're in the stream pushes you along. But until you have jumped into the stream does nothing for you. If the stream is the Dhamma and the ocean is Nibbana, once you're in the stream, the water, the currents, it pushes you along. Your understanding pushes you along the journey. That needs to happen for each and every one of you. You know, every week you come along, ladies and gentlemen, on your way back home, ask yourself that question. Has that happened for me? Not so that you can claim that you have become a Sotapanna. That is not the objective of it. The objective is, have you become someone who can go on this journey without having someone at your back pushing you along all the time, every time? Because let's face the truth. You're only here for 1/14 of your week. Even less than that. 13/14 of your week, you're out there. Only a Sunday after Sunday morning we get to be together. The rest of the time you're on your own. Meaning you are without a teacher. Meaning there's no one to push you along on the journey to Nibbana, but there are plenty who say, hey, when are you going to do your exams? There are plenty of people asking, when are you going to finish the work on the house? You're doing some renovations these days, when are you going to have that done? When are you going to pay the loan? When are you going to get the loan? When are you going to get married? People will keep asking you those questions. When are you going to have your first child? When is she due? They'll ask you these questions. When are we going to have that party? When's the next anniversary? When are we going on that trip? Don't you have people asking you these questions all day long? But how many people come up to you and ask you, when are you going to achieve that day where your happiness is unshakable? How many people ask you that question? How many? No one. Because in that game, you are alone. You are a lone warrior. Therefore, I need that to happen within yourselves. I need for this to happen within you so that even if you die today, you'll still be okay. See, that's how much I care about it. It's not the face that I see in front of me I care about, ladies and gentlemen. It's not so. This face is just your face for this birth. What about when you're dead? What about what happens after that? I'm trying to set you on track so that even when you die, you still have refuge. If you become a sotapanna, your task is done. Then the Dhamma will do the rest for you. Your comprehension of the Dhamma, your understanding, your realization of the truth will do the rest for you, just as much as your understanding of a lie has ruined it for you. It's the same thing. Yesterday we had the last of the functions of the 8-day long Pinkama that we had at the monastery. So for this event, all of our monks, everyone resident at the monastery, the Anagarikas, Anagarikas, and the children, almost 400 of us, we all stood around the stupa, around the pagoda, in formation, and we chanted Pirith. Because it was the moment where the last of the relics were deposited and the relic chamber was being shut. So as we stood outside, I was just doing what I normally do, which is contemplating on the Dhamma. As if it was planned, there was an oil lamp put on one of the circles on the stupa just opposite me, and it was burning bright. So this is a standard oil lamp. You've seen them in the temples. And there was a moth flying around. It was happily flying, flapping its wings, you know, flying left and right and up and down. It was a wonderful moment for contemplation. I wish you were there. I'm going to try and take you there now, if at all possible. So there was the oil lamp and the flame flickering in the wind. And then there was a moth. This moth was attracted to the light. It wanted to be in the light. It wanted to be with the light. It wanted to enjoy the light. Perhaps even, you know, the heat of it was also quite soothing to the moth. So it started flying around. It kept getting closer and closer to the oil lamp. Now you know what's going to happen next. Otherwise, there would not have been a point in me sharing this story with you, right? But I want to share with you the thoughts that I had as I was observing this, because for me it was a meditation. It was a moment for pure contemplation, such profound contemplation, and I want to share that with you. Fortunately, it happened yesterday, so I can share this story with you today. As I remember it perfectly. So this moth, it kept getting closer to the flame. And then at one point, it landed on the lamp. But not on the flame, just on the brim of the lamp. Now it's feeling the light. It's bathing in the light, right? And the warmth of the lamp is also very soothing. So it starts moving closer. Closer to the... Of course we know it's not going to jump into the flame because the flame is too hot, right? It flapped its wings for one last time. This time it fell into the oil. So this is hot oil. As the wick is burning, of course, it heats the oil that it comes into contact with. This is hot oil. Now I could see right into the lamp from where I was stood. Now I know some of you are thinking, why didn't you save the poor thing? I knew you'd. I saw that coming. Wasn't your job to save the poor thing? I am saving the poor things. Don't you see? I can't save a moth from death. I can save those who are about to be moths from becoming one. The Dhamma is the only refuge. Had I saved the moth, don't you think another death would have come to it? Maybe that was a better death than being crushed. Maybe someone would have walked over it. Perhaps that would have been a finer death. Or this death that it had would have been a less painful death. Who knows? Maybe another animal would have made prey of it. Who knows? There's no point saving in that sense. I save lives, I do, ladies and gentlemen. I do. This is what I'm doing. I'm saving lives. But you won't see me at the abattoir saving cattle. You won't see me do that. Because even if you try to save the animal from being slaughtered, it's going to die anyway. Heartless, aren't I? But that's not to take anything away from those who feel that it is their duty to save cattle who are destined to be slaughtered. If that is your thing, please go do it. It's perfectly fine. And that is meritorious. Yes, absolutely. But I see a much bigger purpose in my being a monk and in me having understood the Dhamma. I want to save lives with the Dhamma because I don't have money. If you go to the butcher, you may have to pay some money to save a cow. You bring it home, or you donate it to somewhere. But one way or the other, it's going to die and back in samsara. It's like washing a piece of cloth and putting it back into the dirt, and then washing it again, and putting it back into the dirt, and washing it again, and putting it back into the dirt. Let me know when you get the point. Picking it up, washing it again, and putting it back into the dirt. But, you know, there are people who do that, and with all due respect, you know, if that earns, because it earns them merits, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that, and I think people should continue doing that. That's fine, because they accumulate merits out of it. There are those who fight for animal rights, for instance. There are those who fight to save, you know, stray dogs. I know people who do that. And never, not even with a single word, do I discourage them. Because it earns their merits. So, fabulous. I encourage that not on behalf of the dog. I encourage that on behalf of the person who does it because it earns their merits. Because you save a stray dog, don't you think that dog's going to die anyway? Yes, maybe it might be able to live the rest of its life in a good home. And then what? I'm not interested in giving a good life for 2 years, for 3 years, for 5 years. That's not my purpose. My purpose is trying to give people a good life for eternity. That's where my focus is. And that is why I didn't bother saving the moth. He wouldn't have done much. So I watched this moth. It landed on the lamp. It fell into the hot oil. And then it started, it's flapping its wings, trying to get out, but now it's too late. Because with the oil on its wings, there's never any hope of it ever going to fly again. It struggled. It made several attempts to try and get out of the lamp, but it couldn't. And then it stopped. Now here's the thing. I want us all to take a lesson out of this. True, the moth did not touch the flame. It wasn't burned by the flame. It only fell into the oil. But here's the thing. You know that wick? It burns the oil, right? It burns the oil in the lamp. In fact, what it does is it takes everything in the lamp to burn and give out light and heat. That's what the oil lamp does. I couldn't help myself but think, hasn't the moth become the fuel to the lamp that attracted it in the first place? Look at what pleasure does. The moth was attracted to the light. It took great delight in the light. And then it flew into the lamp. And now it has become part of what has to be burned to give off that light. Because in a moment the wick is going to burn away, and then the last bit of it is actually in the lamp, isn't it? If you've seen the last, you know, the last bit of oil being burned in a lamp, the flame actually comes into the lamp itself. It's no longer at the edge of it because now the last bit of the wick is in the lamp. So the last bit of oil is going to burn with the moth. Now who's become the fuel? The moth has. Is that what it wanted? All it wanted was to experience a bit of pleasure. It wanted to experience happiness, satisfaction, joy, but look what happened to it in the end. Now you may be feeling sorry for the moth, and you may even be inspired. I want you to be motivated. How does this story help motivate you? Don't you see a moth within you? Have you not become the fuel that burns the pleasure that you have gone after? People don't realize this. Let's take a few examples. Let's say you enjoy watching TV, watching a film, whatever, right? You sit in front of your TV, you put the TV on and you're watching your TV. You're watching a film. It seems fun, it seems enjoyable, you're watching it. Where does pleasure arise? Where's beauty, by the way? Which is the same question. Is beauty in these flowers? Is it? Its beauty is not in the flowers. So, is beauty in the eye? They do say beauty is in the eye of the beholder, but is it in the physical eye? It's not. Where is beauty then? In the mind. So, beauty is a creation of the mind, right? Now, if you listen to Gaura Maghahandra's sermon from last week, from when you visited the monastery, he would have explained to you that pleasure is a phenomenon that is experienced in the mind when the mind relieves itself from vexation. There is no other way to experience pleasure other than putting yourself through pain in the first place. Prove this wrong and I'll come home with you tonight. I will disrobe, get back into my shorts and my, you know, I'll get back into my lay clothes and I'll come home with you today and be your servant. If you can prove to me that this is wrong, once again, Pleasure can only be experienced. By putting yourself in pain in the first place. I proved this to you with a simple example many, many, many weeks ago. If you bend your finger backwards to the point where it hurts and you can't bend it any further, it becomes excruciatingly painful. And now when you let go, it feels good, doesn't it? Where did that goodness come from? Was it there in the finger? So why don't you experience it without bending it backwards? Can you get that experience without inflicting pain? You can't. To experience the pleasure of relief, you have to experience the pain that you put yourself through first. This is a real curse. And we need to open our eyes to this, ladies and gentlemen. Now, an example that you'll be very familiar with. After a Sunday morning sermon, most of you will be looking for the what? It's cold in here. What will you be looking for? The washrooms. Yeah? When you go to the washroom and you relieve yourself, how does that feel? Feels good. Why? Because you have relieved yourself of the discomfort that was building up inside you. But once you have relieved yourself, can you experience that joy after that? 2 moments after that? A minute after that? Can you experience that? No, it's gone. It's gone for good. To have any hope of experiencing that again, you have to go through that physical discomfort once again. When you all walked into this room, you would have sat down in a particular pose. Right? You would have sat down in a certain way. Whichever way, let's take from now on, you're sat in a certain way. Can you promise me that you will be in this position until the end of this talk? You can't. Why not? Because after a while, it gets uncomfortable. So if it gets uncomfortable, why are you purposely sat in an uncomfortable position? Are you nuts? If you know that this is an uncomfortable position, why do you sit in it? Here's the deal. It's not uncomfortable now. But it gets uncomfortable in a few moments. And then what do? You shuffle yourself. You adjust yourself and you take on a more comfortable position. Is that the comfortable position then? It's not. Because what's going to happen again? Once again, it becomes difficult and uncomfortable. The moment where you experience the joy of physical comfort is the moment where you shift from an uncomfortable position, or there is no such thing called an uncomfortable position because you never take that position, if it were. The moment where that tension starts building inside you, where the discomfort starts building inside you, and the moment where you relieve yourself in that situation is the moment where you experience pleasure. See, don't you see that you are the fuel that has to burn to experience that pleasure in the first place? Because what do I mean by you having to be the fuel? Think of that moth. That moth went into the flame because it enjoyed the light. It wanted to experience the light. Ultimately, it had to become the light. Didn't it? And the moment it experiences the light, the moment it becomes the light, does it experience that light? No. Why? Because it's dead. Understanding this phenomenon alone, ladies and gentlemen, is enough for one to become motivated to Nibbana. The first thing that needs to happen within all of you is for you to fall out of love, not with your spouse, for you to fall out of love with pleasure. For every moment you seek pleasure, is another moment you punish yourselves. The moth only had to sacrifice itself in the lamp because it was attached and attracted to the light. What it didn't realize was, soon enough, it was going to become the light. The moth never realized that. Do you? I ask you. I'm trying to get you to focus on an individual chitta here. It's going to get a little bit deep from here on. So pay attention. But all of you can understand this. You can. I'm going to try and give it to you as simply as I possibly can. We'll use examples and all sorts. But you need to make your effort and I'll make mine. Together we can make magic happen. Take a moment where you're eating something that you enjoy. Let's take a bar of chocolate. Most of you like chocolate. Is there such a thing called pleasure in chocolate? Is there? Is there pleasure in chocolate? No. How do you prove this? Let's prove this. We've proved this before, right? But let's go through it two more times again, just because there are a few new people in the audience. How do you prove that there is no pleasure? The pleasure that you experience when you eat chocolate is not in chocolate. How do you prove that? Quite simply. If there is such a thing called pleasure in chocolate, the more chocolate you eat, the more pleasurable you must feel. But how do you feel? There comes a point where you get sick of it, don't you? Yeah. So now, just apply scientific thinking. How do you know that fuel, temperature, and oxygen are the factors that give light to a fire? Because the more of it you add, the bigger the fire is. Does it come a point where you keep adding oxygen and the fire burns out? No. That is the scientific method. The scientific method dictates that you must, if X gives you Y, more of X must give you more of Y. Yeah? Right. So then, is there pleasure in chocolate? Initially, it seems like it. When you eat chocolate, if that's X, you experience pleasure. That's Y. Keep adding X, what must Y do? Increase. But there comes a point where you get sick of it. Then you must come to the conclusion that it is not X that gives you Y. Do you all agree with me? Very simple. Buddhism is not difficult. People try to make it difficult. It's not. Buddhist philosophy is so, when you have intelligence and a little bit of wisdom within you, understanding the Buddha's teaching, you know, he taught the Dhamma to mere mortals like you and I. He taught the Abhidhamma to the Devas. There is not a single sutta where the Buddha has taught Abhidhamma to a human being besides the Sariputta Thera. That's why I always say, you don't need the Abhidhamma to attain Nibbana. Many thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of human beings attain Nibbana not by listening to a single discourse of Abhidhamma from the Lord Buddha. Not a single discourse of Abhidhamma, because all of his Abhidhamma teachings were either given to the Devas or to one and only, who was only second in wisdom to the Buddha. That was a great Sariputta Thera. So it fails me why some people believe that they have to study and understand the Abhidhamma to attain Nibbana. But I have empathy because I was also one of them. None of you are fools compared to me because I was the biggest fool. So compared to me, you know, you're all perfectly fine. I thought Abhidhamma was going to get me to Nibbana. So I studied it right, from page to page. And by-hearted all of that. The chittas, the chaitasikas, the rupas, and all of that. All the realms of existence. I can't remember much of it now. But I'm happier now. So you don't need to worry about Abhidhamma. Hopefully I have convinced you of that fact, because the Buddha never gave a single discourse of Abhidhamma to human beings. It was only given to the Devas. Only the great elder Sariputta Thera was the recipient of a synopsis of his teaching. That's how the Abhidhamma Tipitaka came into being. But he was most certainly taught by the Buddha. There are some schools of thought who believe that the Abhidhamma was not taught by the Buddha. It was a later commentaries. They brought it into the sasana. But it's hard to believe that that is the truth. Because once you start studying the Abhidhamma, you see how profound it is. Today I realize how deep and how profound the Abhidhamma is. It's like the Buddha showing off what he can do. It's a bit like the twin miracle. You know, when the Buddha shows off, as he spits out fire and water at the same time, it's a bit like that. Teaching the Abhidhamma is a bit like that. So coming back to the point. You just need to be able to apply yourself. Apply the Dhamma to yourself to realize the truths within you. Nibbana is your internalization of the Dhamma. That's all. Nibbana is your internalization of the Dhamma. To study the Dhamma as an academic study is pointless. You'll be inspired, but you won't be motivated. So you're eating chocolate. You take the first bite, it tastes delicious. And when you take the first bite, what do you want to do now? Take the second bite. Is there pleasure in the chocolate? Once again, I ask you this question before we proceed. Is there pleasure in the chocolate? That deliciousness that you taste in a chocolate, is it actually in the chocolate? Is that one of the ingredients of the chocolate? It is not. Chocolate flavor is in the chocolate. That much is yes. So chocolate to an Arahatan Vahanse will also taste chocolate. It's not going to taste like anything else. It's going to taste chocolate. A lime is going to taste a lime. A lemon is going to taste a lemon. An apple is going to taste an apple. That is no different. Because once you study how taste works, we've learned that for science at school, but nowadays we are using that to explain Buddhism as well. Once you understand how taste works, you must realize that tastes are the same for everyone. But the pleasure that you taste, the deliciousness that you taste, that is not in the food. So what is it in? It's it's in a sacrifice. Take that down. Beauty is a sacrifice. And you're making it all the time. Who's the sacrificial lamb then? On the altar of ignorance and attachment, you are the sacrificial lambs who sacrifice their life in the name of beauty. Alas, what has come of us? May the Dhamma heal you, ladies and gentlemen. May the Dhamma show you the light. May you come out of this ignorance that pleasure is the be-all and end-all of life. The only reason you are still there is because you still seek refuge in pleasure, and it's a mirage. It's a mirage. Please understand that. I shouldn't be begging you to understand something that helps you. But if that is what it takes, please understand that pleasure is a mere mirage. It is not what it seems to be. It's a lie. It's the flame that looks so attractive. It attracts you to it, and then you end up becoming the fuel that burns it and keeps it alive. Beauty is a sacrifice. I will explain to you. The moment I said beauty is a sacrifice, I saw a few smiles in the audience, because those are the people who've been listening to these talks right from the beginning. So just a mere few words, you get the gist of it. But I know there are new people in the audience. I'll go through the mechanics of it, so all of us can benefit from today's talk. But if you have got it, start contemplating on this. What if by the end of this sermon, you can become someone who is self-motivated? What if by the end of this talk, I no longer need to worry about your salvation? You will do it on your own behalf. It is possible. I need your attention. I need your merits to step in right now. All the merits that you have done, last 7 days, last 8 days, if ever you visited the monastery, wherever, if you went to your local temple, you offered alms, you offered gilampasa to the Swaminarayan, says you lit lamps, you offered joysticks, offered flowers, you helped your neighbors, you were a good person, a good human being, you've done your duty as a law-abiding citizen. All of those merits, may they help you on this occasion to help you realize the truth of life. You only suffer out of your own ignorance. When you grieve, it is only because of your ignorance, not because your mother died. The death of a mother does not bring grief. Your ignorance brings you grief. The passing away of a loved one does not bring you grief. It's your ignorance that brings you grief. So why become the fuel that burns your own fire? Open your eyes to this truth. Why do you want to be a sacrifice? You are the sacrifice. Let's go back to the chocolate. There is no such thing called pleasure in a chocolate. How do we know this once again? The more you eat it, you don't end up with more and more pleasure. After a point, you get sick and tired of it. You get fed up of it. There comes a point where you actually physically feel sick, don't you? It happens. Another way to prove that would be, not everyone in the world enjoys chocolate. There are those who don't like chocolate. About 10% of the global population, they just hate chocolate. You might wonder, huh? How is that so? There may be a few people in the audience who can testify to that. There's always 10%. So if there are 100 of you here, 10 of you may not actually really like chocolate. But if pleasure is in the chocolate, mustn't all of us love chocolate the same way? But we don't. Once again, proof that pleasure is not in the chocolate. Now, are you convinced that pleasure is not in the object? Anyone in any doubt, please put your hand up and I'll go through more examples. Because I need you to understand this before we proceed. Anyone in any doubt that pleasure is not in the object? Beauty is not in the flower. That is why for some of you this might look like a beautiful arrangement, but for others you might wonder, who did that? Look at it. You're not impressed. Some will say, wow, yellow flowers and white flowers, what a wonderful combination. Others will go, who chose yellow and white for this? It's crazy. They should have picked red and white. This combination will not work for everyone. Whatever is behind me is not good looking to everyone. Some will enjoy it, some won't. What does that prove to us? That beauty is not in the object. If this is beautiful, the arrangement behind me, if this is beautiful, if this is attractive, how about I propose to you, from here on, this is all you get to see for the rest of your life. Would you sign up for that? Besides this sight, for everything else, you go blind. Is that okay? Not okay. Why not? Because after a point, you want to see other things, right? You want to look at other things. Why do you want to look at other things if this thing is good enough? If this has beauty, at which point does it stop giving you beauty? I'll ask the questions, I want you to answer them in your own heads. If this is beautiful, if this is attractive, if this is good looking, at what point does it stop giving it to you? Who decides that? Does it decide that? This is a pretty flower. If this is a beautiful flower, why is it that you can't just keep your eyes fixed on this for the rest of your life? You might tell me, what, Swaminas, we have other practical concerns, you know, we have to go places, we have to do things. Okay, I will do all that for you. I'll look after your kids for you. I'll look after, not your wife, I'll look after your kids for you. I'll pay the bills for you. I'll cook for you. I'll do all that for you, right? But all you can look at is this flower and nothing else. See, those of you who grow flowers at home, yeah, there'll be some among you who are horticulturists. You have flower beds at home. Do you have just the one flower? Just one type of flower, that's it? Why not? Here's a question. In your flower bed, which flowers are the ugly flowers? Which ones are the ugly flowers? Let's put a few names of the flowers that you have at home in your flower beds. You have what? Come on. Roses, right. Orchids. Give me one more. Madam? Daisies, right. Have I spelled that right? Okay, good enough, yeah? Close enough, right. I had chrysanthemums, I don't know how to spell that, so I didn't hear that. Right, roses, orchids and daisies. Okay, so you have, this is your flower bed. Roses are red, right, okay. Orchids. And daisies. Okay? This is our flower bed. Award-winning flower bed. Right. Now here's my question. Think carefully and answer. If you do so, all the answers will come to you. I always say, I don't give you the answers, I ask the questions. I need you to come up with the answers. Why did you plant roses? Because they are pretty. Why did you plant orchids? Because they are pretty. Why did you plant daisies? Because they are pretty. Okay. So, roses are pretty, orchids are pretty, and the daisies are pretty. Right, next question. Which one's the ugly flower? Is it the roses, the orchids, or the daisies? Which one? None of them. So what are they then? They're pretty. Yeah? Okay. So when you're looking at the roses, you say they're pretty. So let's just cover up the daisies and the orchids for a second. Now you're just looking at the roses. Okay? They're pretty, aren't they? Yeah? They're pretty. So if the roses are pretty, why do you need to look at orchids as well? If the roses are pretty, because I gave you a chance to answer the previous question, which ones are the ugly flowers? Because if you'd said the roses were ugly, then I understand you also want to look at orchids and daisies, but then I would have next said, like, let's uproot the roses. Because they're ugly, you don't need the roses there, right? Yes? I'm trying to help you understand the point here. So you told me that you planted the roses because they're pretty, the orchids because they're pretty, and the daisies because they're pretty. Now, I asked you the questions, which ones are the ugly flowers? And you said, none of them, because they're all pretty. So then I asked you the next question, well then if the roses are pretty, why do you need to look at orchids and daisies? Why do you have orchids and daisies in your flower bed? Why don't you just have roses? Because if roses are pretty, and what you want is prettiness. Isn't that what you want? Why did you plant these flowers in the first place? Because they were? Is it merely because they were flowers? Or was it because they were pretty? They were pretty. Are there flowers? I'm sure there'll be flowers that some generally accepted not to be pretty. Can you give me a name? I'm not very good at this, so I need you to help me here. Are there flowers that people don't generally plant because they're not very pretty? Any? No? Coconut flowers? So flowers generally tend to be pretty, right? Now, in some countries, some flowers, they only go on a wreath, right? So those flowers, they don't generally get planted in homes because people believe it brings them bad luck and whatnot, right? So let's say there was a particular flower. Let's call them wreaths. So you have roses and orchids and daisies and wreaths. These are funeral flowers. You don't plant them in your flower beds because you don't like looking at them. It doesn't give you the same pleasure that roses do. It doesn't give you the same pleasure that daisies or the orchids do. So therefore, you don't have any of them here. Granted? Okay. Now, back to my original question. The reason you planted roses was because you said that roses were pretty. If so, the reason you planted roses was because they were pretty, and that is why you didn't plant the wreaths, because they're not pretty by your account. So nothing that is not pretty has been planted. Nothing that is not beautiful has been planted. Then the roses were planted because they were pretty. I ask you the question then, why do you need to look at orchids and daisies? Why? 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 Because the roses don't have prettiness. That's why you want to look at the orchids. So then the question comes, so the orchids are pretty, aren't they? Then why do you have the daisies? Because the orchids aren't pretty either. Then you look at the daisies. So why do you look at the daisies? Because the orchids aren't pretty. So then why do you go back to the orchids? Because the daisies aren't pretty. Then why do you go back to the roses? Because the orchids aren't pretty. So which ones are the pretty ones? Which ones are the pretty ones? None of them. So what must you do then? Uproot it all? Right? Oh, just get rid of the flower bed. But then you don't see pretty. But you put the plants back in, again, once again you see pretty. But you don't see pretty just by looking at the roses. Here's how you see pretty. When you want to see roses, that want has to happen in the mind first. When you want to see roses, and then you see roses, now roses seem pretty. You need that prerequisite. The want has to happen before the action. When you want to see the orchids, and then you see orchids, then it looks pretty. When you want to see daisies, and then you see daisies, then it looks pretty. That is why you can't just keep staring at your flower bed 24/7 and be happy. Even if you loved your flowers, right? There may be some among you who just love flowers. If that is all you got to look at, that love affair won't last very long. What is evidence of that? Any other love affairs that ring a bell? Hmm? Why is she not as attractive as she was on day one? Come on. Why is she not as attractive as she was on day one? Why is it that after a while your eyes start to wander? Come on. Because beauty is not in the object. That's the simple answer. That's why your eyes start to wander. But your neighbors, their eyes start to wander this way. Your eyes start to wander neighbors' way. But then, thankfully, people have social norms, there's a decorum, right? There are rules, regulations that prevent these, let's just say, temptations, infatuations from being materialized. Therefore, people can live in peace and harmony. Otherwise, just imagine if people just went after whatever they thought was pretty. What would happen? What would happen is what would happen to the moth. They would burn and die. See, now there are young people in the audience here. Oh yeah, you're all young, okay? You're all young. But there are some who are particularly young. Let's say naive. You may still be looking for your Prince Charming, some of you. Ever hopeful that one day you will find him. Then there'll be others who will be looking for their Cinderella. Ever hopeful that one day you will find her. I just want you to know that when one of these days you come across this person that you think, that's my Prince Charming, here's my Cinderella, may these words resonate in your minds. You see, I don't mind you jumping into a pit knowing that you are jumping into one. That's okay with me. Then I don't feel like I have not done my service to you. But if you have kept coming to the sermons and you jump into the fire not knowing it's a fire you're jumping into, I, as a member of the Mahasangha, is partly guilty. Because I have not done my service. Make a mistake knowing that it is a mistake you're making. Then it's okay, because at least you will want to rectify that. At least you will fight the urge, the temptation from within. You know this. Go and ask your mother, go and ask your father. Ask your father, daddy. You know, mommy, why did you get married to mommy? Ask him. He'll say, my God, to her, what are you saying? You know, the first day I saw her, she was charming. She was so beautiful. I'd seen nothing more beautiful. And so I thought I wanted to marry her. So then ask him, what about today? Do you feel about her the same way? He'll say, I love her. But, no, I don't think he'll say the rest of it. He won't. They don't speak the truth. They don't speak the truth. But you know the truth. These are the unspoken truths. You know, ladies and gentlemen, that, you know, your girlfriend, your boyfriend, right, the person you love, the person you found so attractive, they are not as attractive 2 days, 3 days, 3 weeks, 3 months, 3 years in to your relationship. And that's why the mind starts to wander. Wander. It looks for greener pastures once it gets fed up. That's the same reason that is going on here. You are okay with roses when you want to see roses. But roses have no beauty in them. Daisies have no beauty in them. And orchids have no beauty in them. And this is why you have all three planted in your flower bed. If roses were beautiful, would you need any of the other flowers? Would you? Would you? If roses were pretty, would you need the other two flowers? Would you? You wouldn't. Because if roses were pretty, and if pretty is what you need, then just have a flower bed full of roses and that's it. But you see, variety, they say, is the spice of life. Unfortunately, they don't let you do that with marriage. They don't let you have that. When it comes to human relationships, people are hurt because people want trust. People want commitment. Yeah? People want commitment, and therefore they can't allow for you to enjoy variety. I'm not here lobbying for variety, by the way. They'd shoot me. That's not what I'm here for. What I'm here to is to help you understand the human condition. Here's what ignorance and attachment are doing to you. You suffer because of ignorance. Whenever you experience pleasure, you're actually suffering. That's what you're doing. Whenever you experience pleasure. Let's try and understand why roses look beautiful. For something to look pretty, you have to want to look at it first. Because when the mind wants something, the mind goes into a state of a vexation. The mind begins to feel that it's void of something. The mind begins to feel that it's void of pleasure. It's void of happiness. It's a bit like, you know, if I ask you to hold your breath, you want to do that now? Here's a practical example. Hold your breath for a second. Not for a second, until I say so. If it becomes very difficult, you can breathe. But hold your breath for a while. Now it's going to become uncomfortable. After a while, it's going to get really uncomfortable. Right? Hold on. I'll wake up and then I'll let you know. Right, breathe. Didn't that feel good? But you breathe all the time, right? Does that feel as good? Why not? If breathing feels good, then you should be feeling that pleasure all the time. But you don't. But then how did holding your breath for about a minute or so and then breathing in, that gush of air seems exhilarating. Was it in the air? Was the pleasure in the air that you inhaled? No. So where was it then? Was that not in a sacrifice? What was the sacrifice? You had to subject yourself to pain and then wait for it and then relieve. It's that relief that brought you pleasure. Not the inhalation, not the exhalation, not the air. It's nowhere to be seen. Pleasure is nowhere to be seen except on the altar of sacrifice. Well done, all of you. Well done. Shabash. Now, do you think I speak to you because I want to convert you all to Buddhists? What do you think? You think I'm here proselytizing you? Or am I here to teach you the truth about how the mind works? Is this not true for Buddhists and Muslims and Christians and Catholics and Jews and Hindus and atheists and all of them? If a Buddhist holds his breath for 2 minutes and then breathes, does he not feel pleasure? If a Hindu does that, do they not feel pleasure? If a Muslim does that, do they not feel pleasure? If a Jew does that, do they not feel pleasure? So everyone feels pleasure. And for each of those individuals, you know, is it only for the Buddhists that pleasure came from relief from vexation, and for the Jews it came from God? For a Muslim, did it come from Allah? And for a Christian, did it come from God Almighty? And for the Hindu, did it come from Lord Shiva? That's my point. I'm not here to give you a religion. I'm here to teach you how the mind works. If you have a mind, these are the laws, these are the principles that govern how the mind works. This is a universal truth for every mind. If you understand this truth, you can be free regardless of what religion or what faith you subscribe to. If you don't, you can keep following the religions, you can subscribe to whatever religions and faiths and belief systems that you do, but you will still suffer. You will still suffer. You know, just think about this for a second. Ask a man who's lived a life devoted to their religion. Okay? Ask a man who's lived a life devoted to their religion what they fear. Ask them what they fear. Take a good Christian and ask a good Christian, "Sir, what do you fear?" Ask him, "Do you fear that you might lose your property?" "No, not so much." "Do you fear that you might lose your children?" "Not so much. I'm a good Christian. I believe in God and God is my Savior." "What do you fear then?" "What if God forgets you? What if God is too busy and He doesn't see you? He doesn't keep to His word." He said, No. God's not like that. God is always true to His word. But what if He isn't?" "Then that would worry me." See, when you seek refuge in anything other than yourself, your happiness hangs on a hook. If you're okay with that, I have no problem. That hook, for some of you, will be your family. For some of you, it will be your property. For some of you, it might be your wealth. For some of you, it might be your education. It might be your profession, might be your job. For some of you, it might be your status. For some of you, it might be your God. "I'm happy because God's there to look after me." What if He doesn't? I'm not suggesting that He won't. It's not what I'm suggesting. But how can a God-fearing man be happy unconditionally? Because what if God has a day off? See, at this rate, God can never take a day off. Because He's got to look after you, 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 got to look after every one of you. God never gets a day off. I can teach you a way to let God take a day off. I think He'd like me for that. He can take a day off. I believe in God just as much as you do, but my God is a different God. My definition of God is, give and you shall get. Deny and you will be denied. Give or deny. G-O-D. That's God. Isn't that what God does? By your definition of whatever God is, isn't that what God does? If you are good to others, what does God do? He's good to you, right? If you are evil to others, what does God do? He punishes you. Is that unfair? No. That's just. If you give good to others, you will get good back. If you give bad to others, in other words, if you deny goodness to others, you shall be denied goodness. Therefore, give or deny. To me, that is God. So does God exist? Yes. The phenomenon, the principle, the law of give and you shall get exists. Therefore, I have no one to fear except for the defilements in my own mind. I fear no one else. I fear myself. Who do you fear? God. I fear myself. Therefore, if I want to be free of fear, what must I do? Tame the beast within. Ignorance and attachment is what brings you fear. Because it is out of ignorance and attachment you get hurt. And what do hurt people do? Hurt people? Hurt people. Hurt people hurt people. So if you're hurt, you hurt others. If you hurt others, God intervenes. You just hurt someone, right? Back to you then. Life is a boomerang. It always comes back. It may be today, it may be tomorrow, maybe in a different form. Today you do things in human form. It may not necessarily come back to you in human form. It'll come back to you in some form. See, I think all religions believe in give and you shall get. Either with God or in some other way. If you are good, God will take him to you, or rather take you to him, into the garden of paradise, into heaven. If you are bad to others, then God will punish you. You will be damned in hell. Yes, I agree. But I am not reliant on someone making a decision about that, because I am the one who decides. Therefore, I have the power to decide. If someone has the power to decide, what else must they have? They must have the knowledge. Because if power comes without knowledge, what if power comes without wisdom? Is a knife a good thing or a bad thing? A knife. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? Because the knife has power, doesn't it? It has a power. It has the power to cut. Not just cut. It has the power to cut. It also has the power to slice. Slice. It also has the power to shave. The same knife that a murderer uses to slice someone's throat, I use to shave my beard. The same knife that can be used to stab someone in the stomach can be used to slice bread to feed their stomach. The knife gives you power, but knowledge is not in the knife. It's in the hand that uses it. It's in the hand that wields it. See, I'm trying to show you that you can become truly independent. Would you rather that, or would you rather be subservient to someone else, whoever that might be, makes decisions on your behalf? And then to them you must please them. To them you must be subservient. To them you must offer yourself. To them you must offer sacrifices and so on. Would you not rather be independent? Because then you and you alone get to decide what to do and what happens to your life. Once again, if you are okay with the prior, which is to be happy with someone else making those decisions for you, then it's fine. There's no qualms about that. But I, for one, would like to make my own decisions and let those decisions determine the outcomes. That is where the Dhamma helps. That is where the Dhamma comes in. The truth is, God is the truth. When you learn the truth, you are. Yesterday we talked about Lord Shiva. Yesterday, Saturday sermon. He is the creator and he is the destroyer. Isn't he? In Hinduism, Lord Shiva, he is the creator and he is the destroyer. He has three eyes. With his two eyes, he creates the world. With his third eye, he destroys the world. How do you create the world? When you open your two eyes. See, when you open your eyes, sight comes into contact with the mind. Ignorance and attachment can also be referred to as the two eyes. Or the physical eyes, if you want to look at it that way. Sight comes in through these eyes and comes into contact with the mind. And it creates your world. The world that you live in is the world that you create in your minds, ladies and gentlemen. Give me a few more weeks and I'll further prove this point to you. What you see is not what's out there. You know the white that you see here? There's no white here. You don't even know what this flower looks like. These are all mental images forming in your mind. You are at the mercy of those mental images. What if the flower is here but the image is here? How do you know? When you look through a telescope, where's the moon? 2 feet away, right? Isn't it? When you look through a telescope, where's the moon? 2 feet away. Is that the moon or the image of the moon? That's the image of the moon. So the moon, when you're looking at the moon, is that the moon or the image of the moon? How do you know? You're at the mercy of your mental world. So when you open your two eyes, you create the world. But when you open your third eye, that is the eye of wisdom, then your world is destroyed. Dukkho loke patittita is how the Buddha described this. The world that he explained is levered on suffering. It hangs on suffering. It rests on suffering. So destroy suffering and you have destroyed the whole world. For that you need to open your third eye. Not the third eye that you might have heard in other places. I talked about a very different eye. This is the wisdom eye. That is what we do here. We try and open our third eye. It does not happen with your chanting. It does not happen with you fasting. It does not happen with you going through austere practices or anything like that. It's not a supernatural power, the third eye that I refer to. It is simply your realization of the Dhamma. If suffering is the world, when you open your third eye, that suffering is destroyed. So wake up and open your third eye. The eye of wisdom. So, do I believe in Lord Shiva? Yes. Today, I believe in everyone. I believe in Allah. I believe in Jesus, I believe in God, I believe in Lord Shiva, I believe in Ganesh, I believe in Krishna, I believe in Rama, I believe in Hanuma, I believe in everyone. Because to me, they represent some aspect of the truth. You see a figure, I see the truth. I don't mean you. Generally people see a figure, You look at that and you think that's the Buddha. I see a truth. The Buddha to me is not a figure. The Buddha to me is the truth. Once you understand this truth, then you can become the Buddha. You can become God. If you want to. Or if you're happy with God deciding what is right and wrong for you, then that's also fine. Whatever you want, we can give you. Have you agreed with me on this point here? It is not roses that are beautiful. Because if it is beauty that you need, it is because beauty is what you need, you didn't plant the wreaths. Right? Otherwise you would have had wreaths here. But you wanted beauty. Remember, it's not the flower that you look at. It's the beauty that you want out of the flower. Why do you eat chocolate? Is it because it's chocolate? Do you eat chocolate because it's chocolate? No, you eat chocolate because it's delicious. Isn't it? Sometimes you even choose to ignore the nourishment that comes with it. Maybe if it's too fatty, too sugary, you choose to ignore all that. Because you focus on pleasure. The mind tends to focus on pleasure. So whatever the mind seeks pleasure, finds pleasurable, it wants to do. It seeks that. Why do people, you know, go on? They do things like bungee jumping. What is that for? It is for the thrill of it. Why do people skydive? For the thrill of it. Why do people jump from heights as an adventure sport? For the thrill of it. Why do people tightrope walk? For the thrill of it. What is thrill? It's the thrill of going on a joyride. Why? Because first you experience pain. Fear. When you jump off a cliff, when you do a bungee jump off a bridge, right? For most of the time you're experiencing what? Fear. If you couldn't experience fear, you wouldn't do it. You wouldn't do it. People do it for the thrill. But you need to understand what this thrill is. What is meant by thrill? Thrill is putting yourself through torture. Fear that something might happen to you and then be saved right at the end. It's like this adrenaline rush that goes through your body. It torments you with fear. But then, as the rope tugs you back, you can breathe a sigh of relief. I'm okay. See, that is like clenching your fist so tightly. And then letting go. You enjoy relief. That relief is what people are after. Don't you see the sacrifice? Look at the sacrifice. The sacrifice. And it hurts. The more it hurts, the more appealing the relief. That's what people do. Pleasure never came from anywhere else. It didn't come from the bungee jump. It didn't come from the sky. It didn't come from the parachute that saved you. It didn't come from anything. It was all internal. All internal. You have to put yourself through torture, ladies and gentlemen, to experience this kind of pleasure. So what is the alternative? Is there no hope for those of us who wish to be happy? Can happiness only be achieved by putting us through such pain and such agony and then freeing ourselves from that? Is that the only way to happiness? No, 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 no. That is where the Buddha comes into this world and teaches us an alternative. It is because the mind seeks pleasure, the mind goes into a state of vexation. But if you can stop the mind from seeking that pleasure, if you can stop the mind from wanting pleasure, Now the mind is in a peace of rest. The mind is tranquil. The mind is serene. It has settled. That equanimity is happiness. But people have never seen that. Therefore, they don't want that. What people want is what they've always known, that is to put themselves through pain and agony and then experience relief from that. Once again, I urge you to wake up from the dream that you're in. Your ignorance is killing you. It is. When you want to eat that chocolate, ladies and gentlemen, pleasure does not come from the chocolate. How many times must I say this again to you? Pleasure does not come from the chocolate. Pleasure comes from the sacrifice you make by wanting the chocolate. When your mind goes into a state of wanting, that's not a state that you find pleasurable. That's not a state that is pleasant. It's a very uncomfortable state. But you put yourself into it. That is the sacrifice you're making. And then when presented with chocolate, you are now relieved from that waiting, from that wanting, from that urge, from that longing. It's not the chocolate that brought you that pleasure. Just like that moth. The moth flew wanting the light from the flame. The light did nothing to it. They're just creatures of habit. They just fly to the light. They don't know that this light is going to burn them, do they? They don't. But then it falls into the oil. And once the oil gets on its wings, there's no hope of flying again. And then what happened to the poor animal? To the poor insect? It became the fuel that burned the flame that it found attractive in the first place. Do you want that happening with your lives? You know, you cook at home the suffering that you then eat. You have to cook it. You are the chef. You cook your own suffering. Only because you believe that soup tastes good. It doesn't. Come out of your ignorance. Once you come out of ignorance, ladies and gentlemen, that's all you need to do. Just see the truth. Come out of ignorance. If you're attached to your children, if you're attached to your spouses, you know that neither your children nor your spouse, today hopefully you know, they don't bring you happiness. Happiness is born within you. If your spouse can bring you happiness, then he or she should bring happiness to every other man or woman. It doesn't. Fortunately, it doesn't. Don't you think so? Aren't you glad that not everyone finds your wife as good looking as you do? Aren't you glad? Because what if everyone did? You think you'd be able to keep her at home for yourself? Do you remember, those days in the times of the great kings, right, when very strikingly good looking babies were born, they went to become girls, young, pretty girls, right? And when after they'd come of age, if they were strikingly good looking, people used to fight over them. And then the king back then decided that she would go on to become the prostitute. She had to become a prostitute so that everyone could experience the joy of being with her, so that people wouldn't fight with each other. Because otherwise, the king is always busy in his court trying to sort out these, fights and arguments and quarrels over people trying to fight over the same woman. So the best thing to do, as the king thought, was decree that she would go on to become a prostitute. And then from there on, anyone who had the money to pay for her services would go and use it. See, so aren't you glad that not everyone finds your wife as good looking as you do? Aren't you glad that not every girl finds your boyfriend as handsome as you do? What if they did? Then they'd all want it. Him or her. And then what would life be like? Impossible. So if not everyone finds your girlfriend as good looking as you do, is she good looking? Is she pretty? Is she beautiful? Then it's not objective, is it? It's subjective. If it's subjective, it's not in the object. It's in the subject. Who's the subject? You are the subject. Meaning, beauty is not out there. Beauty is all within you. But when you don't realize this truth, you think beauty comes from the outside world object. Therefore, here's what you do next. You make it your life's effort, your life's purpose, to somehow try and acquire that object. Once you have acquired that object, now you have to keep it safe. You have to look after it. You have to tend to it. You have to protect it. You become the security guard of that object because you have to keep it secure. Do you pity me for having nothing more than an alms bowl and 3 robes? Come on. Do you pity me for having nothing more than an alms bowl and 3 robes? Why? Why not? Is it you or I who has a peaceful night's sleep? Is it you or I who can live fearlessly? Is it you or I who has to grieve over nothing? Who doesn't have to be worried day and night? Who doesn't have to live in fear day and night? But look at yourselves, ladies and gentlemen. For everything you are mentally attached to, not physically. You can have a watch on your wrist that's physically attached to you. I'm not talking about the physical attachments. I'm talking about the mental attachments. Because fear is not born in the wrist, it's born in the mind. If you're attached to the wrist that's on your watch, No, the other way around. If you're attached to the watch that's on your wrist, if you're attached to the ring that's on your finger, or the person that put the ring on your finger, either way, you will suffer. Suffering is all you will get out of attachment, nothing more. I will speak to you until my throat goes blood red and you understand this truth. Because this is the truth that you must all try and understand to free yourself from suffering. Whether you like me or not, I don't care. I don't care. Because we have come to a point where I don't see that it is your Nibbana and my Nibbana. Nibbana is Nibbana. That's it. I don't care whether it's I suffering or you suffering. Suffering is suffering. Suffering is suffering. See, if you walk into a cancer hospital and you see patients in 2 beds, which patient do you want to heal faster? Heal quicker. Which one do you want to heal quicker? You don't know them, you're not related to them. Which one do you think should heal faster and quicker? Which one? Matters not, right? The doctor comes and says only one of them can be treated on. They will heal quicker. The other will have to take that, will have to wait it out. Which one would you say has to be treated first? You have no preference because they're not attached to you. Now, twist. Plot twist. One of them is your friend. Now, which one should be treated first? Your friend. Now you understand the premise? In the same way, I am not attached to any of you. It's fine if you have to. I am not attached to anybody. If you're not attached to anybody, then who must be healed first? What if there's a day I'm not even attached to myself? If I can see that as a chitta and this also as a chitta, then now which chitta has to be healed first? You or me? If I'm hungry and you're also hungry, but there's only food to serve one person, who out of the two of us must be served first? You or I? It depends on who you're more attached to. That's the answer always. That's why it's always your children before next door children. Before your neighbor's children, it's always your children. It's your wife before someone else's wife. It's your house before someone else's house. It's your increment before someone else's increment. It's always like that. Your promotion before someone else's promotion, because you are always attached to this thing that you call yours, you and yours, me and mine. That is a trap. You think that's a blessing? It's a trap. It's a curse. Because the moment you create this world for yourselves, ladies and gentlemen, all that happens is now you have to be the guardian of this galaxy. You are now the guardian of this galaxy. No one's going to come and fight on your behalf. You have to do that for yourself. You have to now protect yourself from threats coming from the outside. You have to protect yourself from threats coming from the inside. Now you have to protect it. See, that is the kind of lives you live. You have all been born humans, but you don't have the time to enjoy being human. Living in fear and grief is not enjoying being human. Animals do that. Pretas do that. But we are humans. Like I said, we can not only be inspired, we can also be motivated. Because we are humans, we have that gift of thought. We have the gift of forethought. We have the gift of insight. We have the power to make choices and enact those choices. Choices that can take us to a different destination than the one we were always on. I need you to wake up. Take the bull by the horns, ladies and gentlemen, and give it a good shake. Who's the bull? I'll tell you what the horns are. You work out who the bull is. Ignorance and attachment. These are the horns. You figure out who the bull is. And give it a good shake. Give it a good shake. And take those horns off. Please. Come out of the miserable lives that you put yourselves into. Because we have the gift of Dhamma still in bold. It's not going to be there forever. Why are roses pretty to you? See, until you believe that roses have beauty, you will keep on planting your roses in your rose bed, and then you will have to keep it safe. Next door kids, they play ball. And the ball comes over the fence onto your flower bed. Now what are you going to do? It's on your roses now. What are you going to do then? What happens to you now? You get angry. First comes sad, then you become angry. Been there, done that, right? Yeah. I know. The ball falls on the rose bed, now you're angry. Then you go over and you give them a piece of your mind. And every time you're angry, it's poison. To whom? To whom? To you. You know, you can't create anger on the outside, can you? Can I create anger within you? Can I? Where is the only place anger can be created? Within oneself. Is anger a good feeling? Do you enjoy being angry? No, so isn't anger the punishment? You're not punished for your anger, you're punished by your anger. Whenever you're angry, you're being that is the punishment. What for? For being angry. That is the punishment. So if an angry man ever does so, say something to me, I never put my hand on them to punish them because they're punishing themselves. Why should you punish someone who's angry? If your husband is ever angry at home, if your wife is ever angry at home, let them be. They're punishing themselves. Don't you be the one who says, speaks a word out loud. Because the same sin must not be punished twice. Even in a court of law, that's wrong. Because if someone's angry, if you shout at them for being angry, they're being punished twice. That's wrong. What happens if you inflict punishment, one that is not deserved? Now who's wrong? You are wrong. What is the punishment for that? You are angry. See? Anger always punishes the one who is angry. And only them. So if you are victims of anger, wake up. Wake up to these realities, wake up to these truths. Some people live their lives thinking that being angry is being so macho. They think that's being an alpha male. I'm the angry one. Don't anyone mess with me. No, I've seen some people who are like that. They define themselves by their anger. I'm the angry one. There's not a man in this land who can mess with me when I'm angry. Don't awaken the beast within me. If you are like that, take pity on yourselves because you're being punished by your anger. Why are you angry? It's because of this. You see beauty in roses. For as long as you think that beauty is in the roses, when that ball falls on the rose bed, now you're angry. If you recognize that beauty is not in the rose, now these are just flowers. Now a ball falls on it. So what? Because it's not the flowers you wanted. You wanted what? Beauty. Beauty is not in the flower. You have now learned that. You have now understood that. So now when a ball falls on the flower bed, so what? It's just an incident, not an event. You transform incidents to events. Ignorance and attachment does that. There are only incidents in this world, not events. Let an incident be. Incidents happen. You create an event out of it. I want to leave you with this for today. Is there beauty out there in this world? Is there pleasure in a piece of chocolate? Is there beauty in a sound? Is there pleasure in taste? Or in a smell? No. But the mind, ignorant to this fact, to this truth, presumes that there is all this in the outside world, in sights and sounds and smells and tastes, and even in touch. There is a mental element of touch as well. But take sight, sound, smell, taste for the time being. We'll talk about touch in more detail later. But pleasure is always pleasure in the mind. If you don't accept this truth, ladies and gentlemen, you are like the moth that flies towards the light that is pleasure and then has to sacrifice to become the oil that burns the wick that gives us the light. You will have to sacrifice with your life. Each chitta that arises and passes away, right now, because you are nothing more than that. You are not the chitta that arose before this. You are not the chitta that will arise after this. You are just the chitta that is available, that has arisen in this moment. Agreed? You are just the chitta that is available in this moment. In this moment, if you want to experience pleasure, you have to sacrifice this chitta. You have to. You have to sacrifice this chitta on the altar of ignorance and attachment. And when you do so, you begin to vex. And once you begin to vex, you will somehow, if possible, be relieved from that vexation. And at that point, you experience pleasure. That is the reward that you get for the sacrifice. But that reward is not one that came from the outside. It was not God-given. It did not come from the outside world objects. It did not come from any experience whatsoever. It was merely your own relief from the vexation that you got yourself into. Is it worth making that sacrifice, I ask you? Is it worth making that sacrifice? Don't excuse yourselves because you are lame. It makes no difference. Whether you're lay or you're clergy, you will suffer because of ignorance and attachment. Lay or clergy is merely a lifestyle choice. It's only in the way we dress. It's in the way we eat. It's in the way we live. It's in the way we do things. That's all. But minds are minds are minds are minds. There are no lay minds and clergy minds. Your minds will suffer just as mine if your mind is ridden with ignorance and attachment. Mine will suffer just as much as yours if it's ridden with ignorance and attachment. The only hope any of us have is to free our minds from ignorance. For that, you have to have the light of wisdom. And wisdom is Dhamma. I don't have the words to describe what I'm feeling right now. If I could, I would punch it into you. Come on, people. We are in the Buddha's era. I have no words to describe to you the compassion with which the Buddha must have proclaimed the Dhamma. As I sit on this Dharmasana, I can feel it. It's running through my blood right now. I can feel it. But I only have the mechanism of the devices of words to get this across to you. Oh, how I wish I could implant this Dhamma into your minds. Oh, how I wish. How I wish I could just touch you on your head and the Dhamma would simply transfer from me to you. Unfortunately, it doesn't happen. It's only words that can do this. And words fail me every single time. Every single day I get back into that car and on the way back home meaning to the monastery, I always think, no. I could have said that a little bit differently. Maybe they were not the right words. Did I actually convey the gravity of it? The profoundness of it, was I able to convey that? I always think to myself. I know words will always fail me because wisdom is not contained within words. It's a realization. But hey, what do we have? What can we do? All we have are words. That's why you need merits. That's why you need merits. Because merits will complement the words. You got to have the merits on your side. The words will come from us. Without the merits on your side, no matter what words I use, you will not understand it. But your merit power will help you to understand really simple words. You know, just a few words, and it'll all become clear to you. Think about the great elder Sariputta Thera. No, he was merits walking on two legs, right? The Buddha just had to utter short phrases. Just the gist of it, and he got it all. See, that is what merits can do. So, do as much merits as you possibly can. Start at home. Charity starts at home always. That's why I always tell you, look after your parents. Do the most you can for them while they're still alive. Do for your teachers. Do for your siblings. Be grateful for all that they have done for you. Right? Today, maybe they know there's a bit of a misunderstanding in the family. But don't let that spoil all the goodness that they have done for each other. Be the better one, always. And look beyond the mere misunderstandings. Reunite the family wherever you can. So that people can live happily as a family. And then once you have that peace and harmony in the family now, that's a perfect breeding ground for the Dhamma. Then you can start to plant the seeds of Dhamma. Maybe your sister and you don't see eye to eye today. But if you can cross that bridge Rekindle that old relationship with her. Perhaps she will join you on Sunday mornings again. I know it sounds like a lot to do. I sometimes wonder whether I have enough life left within me to do all the things that I want to do. Sometimes there's just so many things going through my head, I don't know which one to do first. I find myself in that situation all the time. You know, if you just take our monastery for instance, there are the children, there are the anagarikas, there are the anagarikas, there are the monks, and there are the devotees, there are the sravakas and the sravikas and the uvasis and all sorts of people. There's the dhammapasala. And you wonder, where should I go and help next? It's mind-boggling. And then I wish, oh, how I wish I had 100 more years to live. But then I realize, you know, that's not my part. My part is to create enough people so that they can live on for another 100 years, not me living for another 100 years. If this legacy can live on for another 100 years, for another 200 years, even if I could live for another 50 years, that's the most that I can do. But in the next 50 years, if I can create more people in this army of the Buddha Sasana, they will live on, each of them, for another 50. If I can do that with 10 individuals, that's 50 times 10. That's 500 years. With my 50, that's 550 years I have lived. Isn't that what the Buddha did? The Buddha dies in another 2,500 years. He didn't die 2,500 years ago. Because he created an army. And you are also soldiers in that army. I need you to understand this, folks. Don't take this responsibility lightly. You have come across the Buddha's teaching and it's not a light responsibility. First of all, do what you have to do for yourselves. Your responsibilities, your duties, you know, to your family, to your friends, to all that, to the country, to your workplace, do all that. That must happen. That is number one. Secondly, do what you have to do for your salvation. That can happen alongside number one. It is not that that only happens on a Sunday morning, the rest happens every other day of the week. It's not. Because this is an attitude that you have. Your attitude is only visible to you. No one else knows with what attitude you do things, right? That attitude can be with you always and all the time. Contemplate on the Dhamma all the time. When you go back home, and if there's a flower bed at home, water it. You don't have to pluck it all and throw it away today after heading back home. Swami Nansa said, no point in flowers. No, I didn't say that. I didn't say that. Maybe you're a florist. Maybe that is your job, your profession. Next time the next customer walks in through the door and asks, will you have some lovely flowers, Mirai? No, no, none of these flowers are lovely. Don't say that. From the bottom of your heart, serve them. They have come looking for happiness. Give it to them. Give it to them. If they like you, they'll come back again. If you make them happy, they'll come back again. It's not the flower, it's how you make them feel. They'll come back again. What you say, people forget. But how you make them feel, they remember for the rest of their lives. Then they'll come back a third time. They'll come back a fourth time. Then you'll start to have a conversation. Chit-chat. Then you might just say what you do on a Sunday morning. Then the next time they say, right, can I have these flowers to take home? You know, you said you go somewhere on this Sunday morning and you offer flowers to the Buddha. Right, here's one from me. Can you offer that on my behalf? Then you bring your flowers and their flower that they have donated and you offer it. The following week they'll ask you, what happened with that flower? I offered it at the Buddha's feet. Would you like to come and do it yourself next time? See, you're creating, paving a path. The Buddha did that so many times. What did he do with Alavaka, the demon? Out you go, and he stepped out. Come back in, and he walked back in. Out you go, and he stepped out. Come back in, and he did again. Out you go. No. I did everything you said. Now, you do as I say. See, he was paving the path. I want all of you to have that, an abundance of compassion. Be loving kindness and compassion on two legs, folks, because the world needs people like that. You know all of the chaos that's going on out there. Countries on the edge of warring. Two political leaders are probably on either side of the globe with a button just under their thumbs, ready to press. And then nuclear warfare will come after that. People live in such fear. They say they live in developed countries, but how developed are they if they can't sleep peacefully at night? I mean, what is that development? If you can't have a peaceful night's sleep, are you developed? Are you mature? If you always live in fear and agony and grief and worry, are we a developed nation? Only the Dhamma can heal. The Dhamma is not the Buddha's Dhamma. It doesn't belong to the Buddha. Because he never invented it. He discovered it. America doesn't belong to Christopher. He only discovered it. He didn't invent it. The Dhamma was discovered by a certain individual. We call him the Buddha because he discovered Buddhaness. That's why we call him the Buddha. Now it's down to each and every one of us to discover it for ourselves. So please, wake up to the light. Open your eyes. Broaden your horizons. Don't constrain yourselves to the mundane life that your friends and your families have always indoctrinated into your lives. Your TV is not your savior. Don't take it as gospel truth. Half of it is that, actually 99% of it is lies. Because they need that for the world to keep going on. Lies upon lies upon lies upon lies. It's mere entertainment. Don't make your TV set your savior. Don't take the newspapers as your savior. You can read it if you want to find out about what's going on out there. But you need to save yourself. Your music is not your savior. A lot of young people these days, you know, they live their lives with those things in their ears, but nothing in the middle. Don't you feel for them? Don't you? Can't you love every child as you love yours? I can, and I don't even have any children. I can love each and every one of your children as if they were mine. And that is why some of you have already come to the monastery and left your children there, because you know that we will love them just as much as you do. And actually, we will give them something more than you can ever do. You can feed them, you can give them an education. You can teach them to tie their shoelaces, but how do you teach them to be free of fear? How do you do that? Only the Dhamma can do that. So save yourselves. When you head back home, you look at the flower bed, ask yourselves, are the roses really beautiful? As you walk down the street and you see a beautiful person approaching you, your eyes might take a trip that way. It's okay. Allow them if you must, but then still ask yourself the question, am I looking at beauty or is this merely a sacrifice? Is it worth it? Some of you may like to please your eyes. Maybe that's what you do all the time. Maybe you still have habits that you're trying to break. Maybe still you have to clear your browsing history before you get off your computer. And you're 45. Time doesn't heal. The Dhamma heals. When are you going to stop putting yourself on incognito mode? When are you going to stop your private browsing sessions? When? Why do you put yourself through this? You know it's a guilty pleasure. You know it's not real fun. You know it's not real happiness because there's a fire burning within. You know this. You know when your heart starts pounding and your conscience starts accusing. I'm a father of two. I'm a grown man. What would my father say if he saw me do this? Your conscience accuses you. The fire burns you from within. Desire is a fire. Natthi rago samanaggi, the Buddha says. There is no fire like the fire of desire because it doesn't stop. When you're angry, there's only so much you can be angry, you fall unconscious. Because there's a safety mechanism that kicks in within you. There's only so much anger you can tolerate. After that, you fall unconscious. But what about desire? Is there a limit to desire? There is no limit to desire. Just like a forest fire that will burn until every leaf and every twig has been burned to ashes. If the fire of desire ignites within you, ladies and gentlemen, it will burn you to the core. Until every cell in your body has been consumed by that fire of desire. Don't take my word for it. You know what I'm talking about. Why put yourself through this? Come on. Why put yourself through this? When beauty is not in the flowers, how can beauty be in a girl? How can beauty be in a woman? How can beauty be in a naked woman? How? How can beauty be in a man? It's not. It's not pornography I have anything against. It's you suffering. Your children suffering. But vexations are so tormenting. When it strikes you, there is nothing you can do about it rather than succumb to it. But why? When you have the Dhamma, when you open your eyes and you realize the truth, you will be free like I am today. It's possible. It's doable. It's achievable. Take my word for it. Try it. Do it. Free yourself from these guilty pleasures. Because there's an ultimate pleasure, an ultimate happiness that is untainted. You don't have to feel guilty about it. And you don't have to do anything to achieve it. It's always there with you. Always there. Even when you sleep, it's there with you. But right now, maybe the only happiness you have in life is when you sleep. When you wake up, that happiness is lost. The happiness that I'm talking about, it's there with you throughout, even when you sleep. Come on. Experience the Sambuddhasasana. There's no point in just calling ourselves Buddhists. There's no point in just worshipping the Buddha, or worshipping the Dhamma, worshipping the Sangha, offering alms. You know, you do your duties enough and more. Over the last 8 days, you've been coming to the monastery in groups of 10, 20, 30, hundreds. You've been making your offerings. You've been depositing your copper leaves in the pagoda, making your adhisthana. You've been doing all these things. But it's only the Dhamma that can heal you. Yesterday, we had the closing ceremony. And I was offered, I was given a casket with a relic in it to take with me to make the final deposits into the relic chamber. And all the devotees there were there, including some of you as well. We could see the obeisance that you had with you, the high, the respect and the devotion. And this is what I was thinking to myself. If there's so much respect for a mere fragment of an arahant's remains, if there's so much people who are on their knees if there's so much respect and regard for a mere fragment of an arahant's ashes, whatever remains after his cremation, just imagine how much respect and devotion we must have to the Dhamma that created that. Because it is the Dhamma that created the relic. Otherwise, it would have just been ashes. It is that Dhamma today you have. How fortunate do you think you are? You may not have an arahant with you, but you have what makes an arahant with you. How's that for size? So do what you have to do, folks. Let the Dhamma heal you. Take the Dhamma and contemplate whenever you can. It's one thing to listen to the sermon and go back home and come back the next Sunday. Very little will happen for you if you do just that. That's why I ask you, reflect. On your way back home, contemplate. At home, contemplate. When you see the next pretty girl on the street, contemplate. Ask yourself the question, is it she that is beautiful or is it I that's making a sacrifice on the altar of ignorance and attachment? Is it worth it? You're paying a heavy price. A heavy price, a hefty price you're paying for a mere fleeting moment of pleasure that never even came from the object that you set your eyes on. If that is not an illusion, I don't know what is. If that is not a mockery of your intelligence, I don't know what is. If that is not an insult to having been born human, I don't know what is. Don't let ignorance have the last laugh. Man up. Fight. You are warriors. You have been blessed with the Dhamma. Wake up to the truth. Let it go in through your ears and let it touch your heart and transform you. Let it do for you what it has done for me. I speak with conviction because I experience the freedom that comes with it. I'm not suggesting for one second that I'm completely free from desire, aversion and delusion. But to whatever extent I am free, if this feels so good, let's say I'm only free from just 1%, if 1% feels so good, my gosh, I can't wait for the day when I am entirely free of raga, dvesha and moha. People sometimes ask me, have you never wanted to go back home just for a day? Not even in my dreams. I'm not a monk because I want to be a monk. I'm here because here's where the Dhamma is. I have such devotion to the Dhamma. I have such regard for the Dhamma. It's one thing to have devotion and regard for the relics of the Rahatan Nuhansis, even the Sarvagnidhatu Nuhansis. But what about the Dhamma that created the Buddha? What about the Dhamma that created the Rahatan Nuhansi? If you have that with you, can't you become one of them? If you didn't have it with you, all you can do is bring your hands together and say sadhu sadhu. But now you have the Dhamma, meaning you can become a Rahatan once. Why don't you want to leave relics when you are gone? Don't you want to do that? So that others can also think just in the same way that we are doing today. What? Not just worship when they see relics, but also think to themselves, how great must the Dhamma be to create a relic that people world over worship, venerate and revere. Let the Dhamma heal you, ladies and gentlemen. Let it heal you. Take it with all your heart. So when you head back home, as you see beauty, contemplate. As you eat your food tonight, as you have your dinner, contemplate. You will taste food, but you'll also taste deliciousness. Ask yourself, is it in the food? Or is it not merely a sacrifice that I'm making on the altar of ignorance and attachment? And ask yourself, is it worth it? So if you forgot to do this 2 weeks ago, today on your way back home, get into that car and ask yourself, is it worth it? You need a car to get from place to place, but you don't need my car. Because you didn't buy just what the salesman sold you. Yeah? The salesman sold you a car. You bought my car. They never sold you my. You created that in your own mind. Let's conclude for today. Let us all take a moment to transfer the merits that we have all acquired today by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, inviting the Swami Nuhansi to deliver the sermon, listening to the sermon, contemplating on the Dhamma, reflecting upon the Dhamma, inviting others to join us and take part in this meritorious deed, as well as listen to the Dhamma and engage on their path to salvation. First and foremost, let us remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in the receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching, and with immense gratitude towards the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us transfer these merits to all of them. Let us also transfer these merits to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all of the chapters who have dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us also transfer these merits to all monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us transfer these merits to Guru Swami Nuhansi as well as all the other monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarika and Anagarika communities attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to all who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to friends of the monastery, our devotees, who, for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha, including those of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who pass on their know-how and extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits. By the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, husbands and wives, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and elders, our friends, our acquaintances, our teachers, our employers and our employees, and to everyone and anyone who've helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, may they all be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these messages to the Devas and Brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to fulfill and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer these messages to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer these messages to members of the armed forces, as well as the police force who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as those who lost their lives in the wars, be they friend or foe. Let us transfer these messages to those who lost their lives to natural disasters and calamities such as the tsunamis, earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, as well as the pandemics, reminding ourselves that in this infinite long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, friends, acquaintances to us. They will have helped us, supported us, assisted us in any way, shape or form possible and available to them with an abundance of compassion, loving kindness and gratitude towards all of them. Let us transfer all the merits we have acquired to all. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful planes, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you.
Raga ginnen midetnva, dvesha ginnen midetnva, moha ginnen midetnva, Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva. Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva. Mamada siyalu loka siyalu satvayo nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva. Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva. Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva. Raga gini niveva, dvesha gini niveva, moha gini niveva, nivansapa labeva, nivansapa labeva, nivansapa labeva. Tunruvange suvisi ananta maha guna belen sielu loka sielu sattvayoma nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetva. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.